Welcome to Jewish History Soundbites podcast with Yehuda Geber. Immerse yourself in the rich tapestry of Jewish history as we explore fascinating tales and uncover hidden gems from our glorious past. Brought to you by our proud sponsor, Cross River, a leader at the intersection of financial services and technology, committed to empowering the communities they serve. Cross River's steadfast support fuels our mission to preserve our heritage and foster a vibrant future for all. Contact Cross River through their website at crossriver.com.
A date which will live in infamy.
Both of those projects, initiatives, got off the ground because of the Gerer Rebbe.
The 11 Olympic team members slain in West Germany. The Olympic Games.
So gereicht waren die Brüder in Amerika. So tausend Schabes at the Skizzer.
Out of the 24 who were killed were Americans who had come to learn in Hebron.
I say 1 million Jewish children who were made to be cut loose.
Whoever heard such beautiful words, Adonavecho Talmud Bavli.
It is never too little, it is never too late, and it is never enough.
Jewish History Soundbites, bringing alive the world of our glorious past. Here is our host, live from Jerusalem, Jewish historian and tour guide.
Yehuda Geber with Jewish History Soundbites. And this episode, when we continue exploring the story of the Jews in the Russian Empire, the 19th century, so I'm a bit tired of the Pale of Settlement in our exploration of Jewish life in Tsarist Russia, so thought that we would take a bit of a diversion to Jews outside the Pale, or beyond the Pale. The Pale of Settlement, the Tchum HaMoshav in Hebrew. So Jews who lived in Russia outside of the Pale. There's really three parts, because there were three kinds of Jews who legally resided outside of the Pale in Tsarist Russia. Number one, which will be the focus of this episode, if we get it all in, if not, we'll have to get it into two. It's also the most famous and most important historically of the three categories. The other two are rather minor stories. But this first one is, there is a category of Jews who used to live inside the Pale of Settlement, who, quote, earned, end quote, the right to reside outside of the Pale by virtue of their wealth or career, academic achievement, military service, profession, etc. In other words, this was the Tsarist government initiative to reward, again, quote, reward Jews who they felt earned, again, quote, in quotation marks. This is all from the perspective of the Tsarist government. That's why I'm putting all these quotation marks around these words. The right to live outside of the Pale of Settlement. And that is a big story. It's an important story. That's what we're going to focus on in this episode. I just want to give a spoiler to the next two categories, which are much more less spoken about and less famous and probably less important historically. Number two is Jews who lived, and I think we will devote episodes to these other two in the future, so we will get back to them, and that is Jews who lived in areas very, very far away from the Pale of Settlement, which were originally not in Russia altogether, but by virtue of Tsarist conquest from the Ottoman Empire and other countries, in wars and whatever, and these territories ended up in Tsarist Russia, and the Jewish communities there were not required to move to the Pale. They were allowed to continue residing in the places they had been for thousands of years. And included in this category is Bukharian Jews, Mountain Jews, Georgian or Georgian Jews, and other Eastern or Sephardic type of communities who had resided in these areas for thousands of years in some instances. Of particular interest in these stories is the interactions these Jews had with Russian Jewry in the Pale of Settlement. So you have all these Jewish communities who are very far from the Pale just because this was the land that they had lived in all the years, and the Tsarist Russia came to them. In other words, they had conquered these areas in conquest. Another point of interest in this category is the story of the Muslim communities in those areas and how they integrated into Tsarist Russia and how the Tsarist government treated them, considering that they were not Christian either. That's also a great story. So I think we'll do another episode, maybe next week or after Pesach, about this category, because this episode we're going to focus on the first category of Jews who used to live in the Pale and kind of earned the right to move outside of the Pale. There actually is another third category, an interesting one, also rather minor importance, but it's cool. It's an interesting story, and that's the Karaites. Karaim, in English, the Karaites, which are Jews who don't believe or abide by rabbinic law, rabbinic Judaism, Torah Shebaal Peh. So there were many who lived in Russia. Technically, they primarily did reside in the Pale of Settlement in Ukraine, southern Russia, Lithuania, and other places. But after a certain point in the 19th century, they were not legally required to, because they successfully lobbied the Tsarist government to convince them that they're not really regular Jews, so that they can have they don't have to have the restrictions that regular Russian Jews have. So that story is quite interesting as well, and maybe we'll get to another episode about the Karaites. So those are the three categories. Like I said, the second and third one is less famous. Perhaps we'll get to it as well. As mentioned, this episode will focus on the most famous and the most important of the three, to a certain extent, one that had a decisive impact on both Russian Jewish society at the time and even down to this very day. How, as part of an official government policy over several decades in the 19th century, certain types of Jews were permitted to leave the Pale of Settlement and reside wherever they wanted in the Russian Empire. This would have massive ramifications for Russian Jewish society. And the goal of this episode is to answer, hopefully, some or all of the following questions that we can ponder and explore as we journey through this narrative. Number one, when and why did the Tsarist Russian government implement this policy, and what were its goals in doing so? Number two, which categories of Jews were included in this policy? When did they move outside the Pale? How many of them resided outside the Pale? And where did they live outside of the Pale? Number three, what were the components of their Jewish and Russian lifestyle in their new environment? And how did they integrate into Russian society? And was that integration successful? Number four, what were the goals of selective integration? What does the term selective integration itself mean from the perspective of both the Tsarist government and from the perspective of the Jews who participated in selective integration by moving outside of the Pale of Settlement? Number five, how did Jews in the Pale of Settlement who remained there perceive the status and lifestyle of their brethren outside of the Pale and vice versa? How did the Jews outside the Pale view the Jewish masses who were still inside the Pale of Settlement, and what position did the outside of the Pale Jews hold in Jewish society within the Pale? In other words, what was the interactions between the two communities, the millions of Jews, the masses inside the Pale of Settlement, and the few hundred thousand Jews who were permitted or lucky enough or earned the right, however you want to phrase it, to live wherever they wanted? Number six, what changed for Jews beyond the Pale following the traumatic events of 1881, 1882, which is such a decisive moment in Russian Jewish history? What happened to the Jews outside of the Pale following those events and the restrictions and the reactionary measures that the Tsarist government took following those events? Number seven, how did Jewish leadership and politics develop among the Jews outside of the Pale of Settlement? Number eight, in general, we'll want to know a summary and the long-term effects, especially of the Beyond the Pale selective integration experiment in Russian Jewry Are there long-term effects? What are the long-term effects? Are they still with us today? The most important source for this topic, although there are quite a few essays and books and all kinds of things to read that discuss this in passing or have chapters about it or interesting angles of it, but the most important and greatest and most interesting source is actually a book in English for a change, a great, great book by Ben Nathans, who wrote a book, Beyond the Pale. And it's a excellent book, really great summary of the whole story. He's the Mara Deshmaitza. He owns this topic, and many others have gone in his path. The book was published over 20 years ago. Ironically, I read a Hebrew translation of the book, not because I prefer to read in Hebrew, but because that's just what I happened to get my hands on. But the book was originally written in English. He's American, and the book is written in English. So if this topic interests you, you might want to read his book or other relevant research on this topic. In order to understand how this Jewish community got out of the Pale of Settlement, it's worth reviewing how they got in there in the first place. So in order to understand the story of Jewish life outside the Pale, first we're going to backtrack and see how the Pale came to be in the first place, what life was like there, why Jews wanted to leave, and under what circumstances were they eventually permitted to do so. One of the broader prisms through which the story of Russian Jews leaving the Pale is seen is the more general trend of migration. In other words, what we're going to view here is essentially a form of migration, and we can examine the phenomenon of migrating beyond the Pale within the broader context of migration trends of Russian Jews under the Tsars in general, which is a good story too. So let's start with a reminder. Prior to the three partitions of Poland, Jews were essentially barred from living within the borders of the Russian Empire, right? So Jews living in the Polish kingdom, or any Jews for that matter, were not allowed to live in Russia. So following the partitions of Poland in 1772, 1792, and 1795, the Russian Empire inherited 500,000 Jews basically overnight, in other words, over the three partitions. And suddenly this country, who had done everything it could to expel Jews and have zero Jews, went to having the largest Jewish population in the world, basically instantly. Its population would balloon from 500,000 by the partitions to over 5 million by the end of the 19th century and become the world center of Jewry. So now the question facing the government was, what's Tsarist Russia going to do with all the Jews they just inherited? Could they expel them as they had traditionally done in the past until the partitions of Poland? It wasn't so practical. It's such a huge population. It was basically impractical and against the economic interests of the empire. In the interim, while the government was trying to figure things out, what to do with all these Jews, the Jews of the former Polish kingdom and now inside Russia, they began traveling spontaneously to the Russian interior for the first time. Merchants for business, activists for political connections in St. Petersburg, etc. And the government, the Russian government, quickly realized that legislation limiting Jewish movement would be the only way to move forward and prevent the Jews from being permitted to reside in old Russia. In other words, the Russia interior from prior to the partitions. This is also due to protests from Russian merchants who began to view with askance and hostility even the new competition from Jewish merchants who were now arriving from the newly acquired areas during the Polish partitions, and now they were coming into the Russian interior in the new and emerging markets. So Russian merchants protested, the Tsarist government needed to figure out what to do, and legislation limiting where the Jews were allowed to live and how they were allowed to travel seemed to be, from the Tsarist government perspective, the only way to move forward. This was the solution, which was finalized through several stages of legislation over a half a century and finally completed in 1835. So it was a long process. And that was to restrict the Jews of Russia to a specific geographical area, which came to be called the Pale of Settlement. Where was this geographical area and how large was it and what were the restrictions? So the answer is they were restricted basically to the annexed areas from the Polish kingdom, the areas that they partitioned from Poland. In other words, to remain exactly where they were. They weren't banned or expelled somewhere. They were told to remain where they were, where they had lived for centuries. today, that if you just want to look at a map today to figure out where it is, that's today's Ukraine, today's Belarus, today's Lithuania, parts of today's Latvia. Now, the big question is about Central Poland or Congress Poland. Is it part of the Pale of Settlement? Is it really a different category? Because there was a very large number of Jews there and they were restricted. They were not really allowed to move to other parts of Russia. So in general, it's not really considered part of the Pale. There was different types of rules and laws that were relevant for Congress Poland. And Congress Poland for much of the 19th century had a limited autonomy from Tsarist Russia. The Polish aristocracy still had some power there. But so it's kind of part of the Pale of Settlement as far as the restrictions. They were not allowed to move to anywhere they wanted in the Russian Empire, so that restriction was there. But it was not really outside the Pale either, so it's a bit complicated. It's worth exploring the unique status of Congress Poland in Tsarist Russia another time. But they were definitely restricted from living anywhere they wanted in Tsarist Russia. So as far as that's concerned, we can kind of consider it part of the Pale. In fact, so the Jews are allowed to live wherever they had lived until then, until the partitions of Poland. In fact, they were also granted access to the entire, what was called New Russia as well, today's southern Ukraine, where the newly conquered territories from the Ottoman Empire, which was very sparsely settled. So the Tsarist government gave incentives, provided incentives to encourage settlement there and to engage in agriculture and other economic pursuits in order to populate and develop this rather undeveloped area of New Russia, the southern Ukraine. And this, all these districts of the southern Ukraine and southern Russia were incorporated into the Pale of Settlement. So if we look at it from a broader macro perspective, so the Jews were not really, the restriction of the Pale of Settlement was basically to tell them, live exactly where you lived for hundreds of years in the partitioned areas of Poland. Not only that, but we're going to give you additional territory that you're allowed to live in, New Russia, and be able to engage in all kinds of economic pursuits there. This is also the story of Odessa Jewry following the establishment of this very important port city on the Black Sea in 1794. Odessa is actually a good enough story to merit its own podcast one day, but that's how Odessa Jewry develops. It's a very new community, and because of that, it has all kinds of ramifications about how the Jewish community there develops and grows. But in summary, the Jews in Russia didn't have to move anywhere. They were not expelled anywhere. They were even permitted to reside in large new territories, expanding their existing pace in the south with New Russia. The size of the Pale of Settlement was approximately the size of France. Just to give you an idea of how large it was, to give that some more contemporary context, at its peak, the Pale of Settlement had about 5 million Jews residing in the Pale. To compare that to somewhere today, over 7 million Jews live in the State of Israel, which is obviously a tiny fraction of the size of the Pale. Furthermore, the restriction to the Pale was rather similar to restrictive policies that the Tsarist government had of all populations in the Russian Empire in the first half of the 19th century. Until the freeing of the serfs in 1861, everyone in Russia was restricted regarding their permissibility of place of residence and movement and migration, aside obviously from the aristocracy. And having said all this, the obvious question we must ask is, why did Russian Jewry at the time feel that the Pale of Settlement was so restrictive and so discriminatory and such a terrible decree? Why did they feel this incredibly pressing need to leave the Pale, to be liberated from the Pale, to reside outside of the Pale, almost to a point of desperation? You have to see the documentation from that time and, of course, in the collective memory of the Jewish people. This is how historians record it. This is how the Jews remember it in memoirs and in stories. This is equally true in contemporary reports of the time, the Jewish collective memory, the residual effects of the Jewish people on the Jewish people as a whole, academic historical research from then until today. All of them are in agreement regarding how awful the experience of Russian Jewry in the Pale was, how discriminatory it was, and how desperate they were to get out of the Pale. So why Why was it like that? What, they were just told to live where they had always lived. They were even given new territory. And we said it wasn't that crowded. You know, we said comparatively, the state of Israel is much more crowded, and no one seems to be that desperate to leave here. Oh, some people are, but not that many people are desperate to leave here. So what was it about the Pale that made it so bad? So there are several answers to this question. I wouldn't call them several different answers. I would really refer to them as several factors to answer this question. Number one, the Jews were restricted to that area. Now, once you're restricted somewhere, it doesn't matter how large it is. Once it's a rule and it's forbidden to reside anywhere else, that becomes a problem and it becomes a challenge to overcome. That's number one. Number two, it was not a great territorial area. It may have been large, but it was underdeveloped. There was no industry or very little industry there. It was very far from the main cities. It was had a lot of economic downsides to it. Agriculture in many places wasn't good, and Jews were not really permitted to engage in agriculture. And it was not a great area to begin with. Number three, Jews were restricted even within the Pale. Which commercial pursuits were permitted. There were restrictions on them owning land. There were restrictions on engagement in agriculture in some areas. They were not allowed to live in villages in some areas. They were not allowed to live in border areas in some areas, etc. All kinds of additional restrictions. That was part of life in the Pale as a whole. Number four, Jews were not the only ones who resided in the Pale. They were actually the minority of the population. Obviously, Ukrainians and Belarusians and Lithuanians and Poles lived there as well. So the fact that it was only, quote unquote, only 5 million Jews in an area the size of France didn't mean that it wasn't overcrowded, because there were millions and millions of other people who lived there. It actually was quite overcrowded in many areas. Number five, the demographic explosion over the course of the 19th century. They went from 500,000 to 5 million over the course of one century. And they had no option of leaving the Pale. So this massive population growth, it made it much worse, for sure in perception, probably in reality as well. Number six, the Pale was a physical symbol of the systematic discrimination, anti-Semitism, and generally restrictive legislation and practices that the Tsar's government enacted and even increased against Russian Jewry over the course of the 19th century. Some of these restrictions and laws were not about the Pale per se, but the idea and the physical expression of the Pale cast its long shadow over the entire history of Russian Jewry under the Tsars. Number seven, most importantly, and this would seemingly be the overarching factor, the Pale came to be seen as one large ghetto, a restrictive environment from which they were not allowed to leave. Much like the falling of the metaphorical and actual ghetto walls in the 19th century in Western and Central Europe due to emancipation and equal rights, Russian Jewry anticipated and hoped for emancipation and equal rights in Russia as well. And the symbol of the beginning of that journey would be the crumbling of the walls of Russian Jewry's ghetto, which is how they see it, as the Pale of Settlement. When that anticipated emancipation and equal rights did not come, the Pale seemed ever more restrictive, and it became the ultimate symbol that Russian Jewry, unlike their brethren in Western and Central Europe, had still not achieved emancipation and were stuck in the Pale for the foreseeable future. So that's a very important reason. Number eight, related to the previous point and kind of an extension of it. Once the government created a reality in the 1860s that certain privileged classes of Jews can be granted the right to reside outside the Pale, which is the topic of today, and that a Jew can, quote unquote, earn his right to live outside the Pale. So it became this dream and hope of millions of Jews. Can I be like those lucky Jews who get to live outside of the Pale? What kind of life do they lead? They're free. Can I be free too? This generates and feeds upon the desire to leave the Pale, because you see people, Jews, fellow Jews, who have achieved it. In addition to this, I would say also connected to this is the fact that after 1861, also the serfs were freed. In other words, at some point in the 19th century, the Jews were the only ones in Russia who were discriminated against. No one else was. So that's why Jews wanted to leave. And what happens? What's the process of them leaving? So who and when were Jews which Jews and when were the Jews permitted to leave the Pale and reside outside of it? So we'll get to why they were able to soon. As of the new legislation regarding the Jews, which we've mentioned several times, in 1804, the first Tsarist Russian legislation specifically regarding the Jewish population. So that became the first time that it was mentioned that they're allowed to live outside the Pale, which ones were allowed to not really live, but Jews attending academic institutions outside of the Pale of Settlement were permitted to reside outside the Pale just for the purposes of their education. In other words, just for their years of education, and then they had to return. That's what the 1804 legislation stated. The same with Jewish soldiers in the Tsar's military. Once the draft began in 1827, so during their military service, they were allowed to live outside the Pale. When their military service was done, they had to return to the Pale of Settlement. 1835, wealthy merchants were also permitted to do business beyond the Pale, but none of them were allowed to live there. None of these were residence permits. They were travel permits. All three that I mentioned were just travel permits. No real residence permits outside the Pale of Settlement existed prior to 1859. They were only permitted at that point as part of the Great Reforms with the ascension of Tsar Alexander II, following the passing of Tsar Nikolai I and the end of the Crimean War. 1856, the process began. By 1859, the first residence permits were granted for Jews to live outside the Pale. Until then, there were a few limited travel permits, as I mentioned, but no residence permits. It begins in the 1840s. This process, this lobbying process, there were wealthy merchants who were permitted to do business and travel outside the Pale, so they wanted to obtain permission to reside permanently anywhere they wanted across the Russian Empire, and they initiated a lobbying campaign in order to obtain this license from the Tsar. Their wealth was earned in the textile, sugar, alcohol, railroad, and several other industries, and some of them were quite wealthy, so they thought that they would be able to lobby the government and they get them to be permitted to live anywhere they wanted in Russia permanently. Now, through their knowledge of Russian language and Russian culture and the connections they developed with various Russian government authorities, they became the self-appointed new Jewish elite leadership of Russian Jewry even before they got their permission to live outside the Pale of Settlement. The nature of their wealth and connections and travel distanced them from tradition, so they were different from most Jews in the Pale of Settlement at this time, because these wealthy merchants were already more distant from tradition. Yet they saw themselves as the newly self-appointed leaders of Russian Jewry due to their wealth and status. The Jewish community in the Pale was more ambivalent initially regarding this self-appointment, but eventually the Jewish community inside the Pale of Settlement came around and also saw this wealthy merchant class as the new leaders of Russian Jewry. So prior to the first legal settlement outside of the Pale, the stage is already set with something that would become a unique feature of Russian Jewish life until the Russian Revolution. The wealthy and less traditional elite, who would eventually live outside of the Pale of Settlement, they emerge as the new leadership of the poor traditional masses inside the Pale of Settlement. A very unique situation. The next stage in this is permitting, the actual permission of certain classes of Jews to reside permanently outside of the Pale. And one of the stages in this process was the formation of the so-called Kislev Committee, named for the Russian minister who ran the committee, who headed the committee. It was formed initially in 1840. Technically, it was called the Committee Regarding Jews in Russia. The wealthy elite that I mentioned lobbied and tried to influence this committee with limited success. In 1856, in other words, 16 years after the formation of this committee, the goals and hopes of Russian Jewry were finally realized when Kislev convinced the new Tsar Alexander II, who had just ascended the throne of the Russian Empire, to change from the strategy of his predecessor, Tsar Nicholas I, who had his policy was to try to force the Jews to change by sanctioning them or punishing them. Rather, Kislev advised the new Tsar that Tsar Alexander II should instead encourage the Jews to change by removing the legal obstacles preventing them from integrating into Russian life. From here on, quote-unquote, good Jews would be rewarded accordingly. That would be the new czarist policy. The spokesman of the wealthy merchant group, who I mentioned, was the patriarch of the Gunzburg family, the very famous wealthy Gunzburg family, which was the wealthiest Jewish family in Russia. The patriarch of this family was Baron Yozel Gunzburg. He would be the first of three generations of the family, which would serve as the unofficial leaders of Russian Jewry and their liaison to the Tsar's government. The Gunzburg family, by the way, probably deserves their own podcast. His son, Baron Horitz Gunzburg, and his son, Baron David Gunzburg, they were the heads of the Russian Jewish elite. They were extremely wealthy. They saw themselves as leaders. Baron Gunzburg used to refer to the Jews when he would speak to Russian ministers in St. Petersburg. He would refer to the Jews of Russia and the Pale as my Jews. The Russian government recognized him as the leader, the unofficial leader. So the Gunzburgs are a fascinating story as well. They also petitioned the Gunzburgs and the wealthy merchants. They also petitioned the Tsar's government directly at this time for permission to reside outside the Pale of Settlement. In 1859, like we said, permission was finally granted for the following groups to reside outside the Pale. Number one, wealthy Jews, prominent merchants. They were called prominent merchants of the First Guild. It's a whole, you know, it will take too much time to explain how guilds worked in the Russian Empire, but it was the society was divided economically into five different guilds. First, guilds were wealthy merchants and depended on wealth and what you did for a living and all kinds of other things, industrialists, things like that. Just, they were called merchants of the First Guild, but it basically means wealthy and prominent merchants and industrialists. That was the first category that were allowed to now legally live permanently anywhere they wanted in the Russian Empire. Number two, anyone with an academic degree, doctors, lawyers, they were all allowed to live outside of the Pale of Settlement. Number three, military veterans following their release were allowed to live outside of the Pale. This provision was later changed to military veterans from the time of Tsar Nicholas I, because after the draft reform, so the Tsar Alexander felt that that the ones being drafted now, since the draft reform is not such draconian measures anymore during his time, so you didn't earn your right to live outside of the Pale just because you served in the military. But those who served Nebuch under Tsar Nicholas in the army, it was 25 years, a long time, the cantonists, all things like that. So they were allowed to live permanently outside of the Pale, anywhere they wanted in Russia. So with time, this provision became somewhat obsolete because it was only people who had served under Tsar Nicholas. They were getting older and older and older. New military veterans were not allowed to live outside of the Pale. So eventually this kind of became obsolete. Number four, and this was the widest and most important provision, but also the most risky as well, because it would come to haunt them in the end, craftsmen who were members of guilds, balei melacha in Hebrew, any type of craftsmanship. They were allowed, an official legal craftsman who was a member of a recognized guild was allowed to live anywhere they wanted in Russia because they were considered productive for the economy. This latter provision technically opened the door for potentially very significant numbers of Jews, but it would not be so simple, and that's something we'll get into. So the years that we're talking about of expansion from 1859 to 1878 is the years of expansion. There's more loopholes, there's more permissibility for Jews to live outside the Pale, and it kind of stops in around 1878 and almost reverses, especially after 1881, until World War I. There's this regression, there's even a reduction that happens. The total numbers we're talking about is eventually about 300,000 Jews that lived outside of the Pale of Settlement, which is between 6 and 7% of the total Jewish population in Russia. Why is that number important? Because historically, historians and the collective memory of the Jewish people has focused on the 94%, 93-94%, which is natural. Why focus on the 6% when you can focus on the 94%? But in recent years, especially Ben Nathan's and in his wake, other researchers have said, first of all, 300,000, if we look at percentages, it's a very small number, but 300,000 is a huge number. In fact, the Jews living outside of the Pale of Settlement in Russia were were equal in size or almost as large or even larger in some cases than Jewish communities in countries in Western Europe. This is larger than French Jewry. This is larger than Dutch Jewry. This is larger than British Jewry. This is larger than Italian Jewry. And we spend much time discussing all those Jewish communities. A little smaller than German Jewry, but not much. So this 300,000 Jews is a huge number, relatively. If it's relative to the Jews inside the Pale of Settlement, then it's a small number. But it's relative to Jews in Western Europe. It's a rather large number, so it's worth studying them. How did they integrate into Russian Jewish society? What happened to them? What was their relationship with Jews inside the Pale? And all that. And also, it can teach us a lot about Russian Jewish society in general. So because it's a very significant number, so that's something that we would want to devote some discussion to. So what were the goals of this experiment from the government point of view? The goals, as far as the government was concerned, was to be a very slow, very step-by-step process, very measured, extremely conservative. There was no ultimate goal of full emancipation on the European model. The empirical and economic goals were to reward good Jews, to do it in a very slow process. In fact, the religious views of the Russian government never went away. So there was always this Orthodox Christian anti-Semitism and how the Jews can never integrate and they're always going to be a problem. And that kind of conflicted with the empire views and economic goals, which was expansion and more permissibility and allowing Jews to live, especially the good ones who earned it, the productive ones, to live outside of the Pale. So They took things very, very slowly, and they didn't have this like real enlightened emancipation type of a goal at the end of the tunnel. What were the goals of this moving outside of the Pale from the Jewish point of view? Oh, that's a whole different perspective. They saw this as a process of a term that Ben Nathan's coined, which is such a perfect term to describe this process, which he called selective integration. So they saw this selective integration as some sort of process, intermediary process that was going to lead, they hoped and they dreamed, to full emancipation if the Jews earn it by proving their loyalty and productivity. If these good Jews earn it and they get out of the Pale and they show Russia how good they are, then it will lead to a wider and broader reforms, which will lead to from selective integration to full emancipation. So was it going to be emancipation, or is it going to remain selective integration? What does selective integration even mean? And why is it such an important term to understand the whole narrative here? It's because it never became emancipation. It remained selective integration. Selective meaning because it only rewarded specific Jews. Like I said, the wealthy merchants, the ones with academic degrees, certain types of military veterans, certain types of craftsmen. And it was selective, and the integration wasn't complete either. It wasn't, they were never fully free. Even in the best of times, it was a real challenge for dependents and families and children of these people, these Jews who were permitted to live anywhere they wanted. Sometimes their children were not permitted to continue living there. How about those who used to be a certain type of craftsman, but now they stopped pursuing their profession, they retired, or they had a career change? They were no longer allowed to live in the Pale. They had to return. They're no longer allowed to live anywhere they wanted in Russia. They had to return to the Pale of Settlement. Their families and children were always in a precarious situation. Those who were there illegally, very often, they could be banished at any time. Even legal ones, even the best ones legally, they fit into the right categories. They had to pay significant and often discriminatory taxes to enjoy this privilege of living anywhere they wanted in Russia. There were limitations on professions. They were not allowed to engage in government jobs, where they were banned completely. They were limitations on other professions they were allowed to engage in. It was a very selective integration, and they tried to make the most of it. Now, the most famous communities, Jewish communities outside of the Pale of Settlement, were in the two capitals of the Russian Empire, St. Petersburg and Moscow. By the 1880s, these communities had grown to almost 30,000 Jews each, approximately, in St. Petersburg and in Moscow. So, and here, the integration was quite extensive. The Jews there spoke Russian. They were integrated into Russian culture, Russian education. Their kids primarily went to Russian schools. The Jewish community of St. Petersburg attempted to establish a kahal, just like in the Pale of Settlement. The Russian government was not interested in a Jewish community in St. Petersburg being just like in the Pale, so they did not allow them to establish an autonomous kahal. And even for them to build the famous Choral Synagogue in both St. Petersburg and in Moscow, which both still exist today, beautiful, big, beautiful shuls, it took them a long time to lobby it, and the architectural plans had to be approved by the Tsar himself for them to establish institutions of financial mutual aid for other Jews and for education and culture and schools. All that was a long process and challenging. On the other hand, it was these types of communities that, because they were integrated, their institutions were much less traditional. It was also wealthier communities. They also had closer connections to the government. There was the nexus of the challenge of Russian Jewry of tradition versus modernity can be most seen in its extremity in the community of St. Petersburg, in the community of Moscow, much more than in communities in the Pale. The Jewish community of St. Petersburg wanted to model themselves on the Jewish communities of Western Europe. They were some secular Jews completely. There were some traditional Jews in St. Petersburg, and there were even some still committed religious Jews. So it was quite diverse within the Jewish community of St. Petersburg. And in fact, if we look about it in a broader sense, it wasn't that much different than some places in the Pale. Places like Odessa, Warsaw, Vilna, Riga, other major cities. The only big difference was that there was much more wealth in St. Petersburg and a much higher percentage of those with academic degrees. But secularization and the questions of tradition versus modernity, although it may have been more openly discussed in a place like St. Petersburg, it was already happening in many big cities within the Pale as well. These Jews of St. Petersburg, especially, they become the leadership of Russian Jewry. And they have this interesting relationship with the masses, the Jewish communities of the Pale, because they're a self-appointed leadership. They're somewhat effective, somewhat ineffective. The leadership families, like I mentioned, the Gunzbergs, also the Pialikov, Kalman Vysotsky in Moscow, there are others. They lead Russian Jewry. And they're the liaisons to the government. And the hopes and expectations and frustrations and great disappointments of Russian Jewry, both inside and outside the Pale, are felt at most in this Jewish community of St. Petersburg because they're in the middle of all of it. And the big changes come following the pogroms of 1881, 1882. Why? Because the Jews and the wealthy leadership of St. Petersburg and Moscow were helpless in the face of the wave of pogroms. They were not able to do anything to stop it. They were taken aback by them. They were quite shocked by them. And they were unable to stop the subsequent legislation of the May laws and other things which were to the detriment of Russian Jewry. So this became quite an issue. Like, they saw this decades of progress and Jews leaving the Pale and integrating into Russian society and helping, and they're the leaders of Russian Jewry, and here it all seems to be for nothing. In 1881, 1882, and the reactionary years after that, it's a moment of crisis of what has this all come to? Where is the goal now? There is a theory that it could have been much worse if not for the interceding of the Jewish leadership in St. Petersburg with the government. So that's an acceptable theory, because they definitely did feel a responsibility to the Russian Jewry and they did all they could. There's just the Tsarist Russian government wasn't that excited to help out the Jews. But it's definitely not that they didn't try. And following the events of 1881-1882, even for Jews outside of the Pale, it got worse. Numerous clauses are implemented in schools of higher education and other forms of discrimination. So these lucky Jews outside of the Pale of Settlement now see open anti-Semitism against the Jews outside of the Pale in St. Petersburg and Moscow. They're the ones who were the good Jews. They were the ones who earned their right to live anywhere they wanted in Russia. They were the ones who were productive. And now they're being discriminated against. They thought that the Russian government wanted them to integrate and wanted them to come to their universities, and here they're being excluded, numerous clauses and other forms of discrimination. And then one of the most disastrous and decisive legislation that happened for the Jews and for the dreams of living outside of the Pale of Settlement was the infamous expulsion from Moscow. All Jewish craftsmen and others, the only ones who were allowed to remain, were wealthy merchants, and those with academic degrees, they were permitted to stay. In 1892, the Jewish community of Moscow went from 30,000 Jews to less than 8,000. The rest were expelled, an expulsion from Moscow, a modern-day expulsion, which was quite rare in the modern era. There's a traumatic experience for Moscow Jewry and all of Russian Jewry outside of the Pale, and to a certain extent inside as well. The discriminatory measures against the Jews outside of the Pale of Settlement, preventing others from joining this group and expanding its numbers, and even a significant contraction of its numbers. Russian nationalism and the rise of anti-Semitism in Russia particularly affected the Jews outside of the Pale for two reasons, one technical and the other ideological. The technical reason is that the Jews outside of the Pale were a very small minority, so they felt the non-Jewish anti-Semitism and they felt the non-Jewish Russian nationalism very, very clearly. They're the small minority. In the Pale, very often Jews lived in a much more closed Jewish environment, so they didn't see it as much. Number two, the Jews outside the Pale had these expectations. They had made it. They had selective integration. So it was seen as a betrayal to a certain extent, or at least perceived as such, that here we did everything, we tried everything, and it didn't work. And now the Russian anti-Semitism is rearing its ugly head and everything is going in reverse. This is the age of immigration. And the leadership in St. Petersburg, their stance on immigration from Russia, which they saw as disloyal to Russian government and to the Russian country that was starting to accept them because of their their productivity. So they were against mass migration from Russia to the United States. But that story will save for a future episode that I'm going to do on immigration. Some of the most prominent professions that Jews were engaged in outside of the Pale were in academic areas, such as medicine and law, lawyers, famous Jewish lawyers, actually. There are some limitations on how many Jews were allowed to practice law. That was another discriminatory measure, but some of these lawyers became leaders of Russian Jewry in politics and other areas. There's also a very important story, which hopefully we'll get to also, of Russian Jewish university students, because they were integrating into Russian society, especially very not traditional, very far from Jewish religion. And yet they're the first ones to experience anti-Semitism because, surprisingly, and this should come as a shock to no one who's been reading the news in 2024, Russian anti-Semitism is especially prominent on university campuses at this time. St. Petersburg is the center of Jewish politics. Jewish conferences, we'll save that for a series on Jewish politics in Tsarist Russia, because that might be the most fascinating element of this series on Russian Jewry under the Tsars. And in summary, in some ways, Russian Jewish society outside of the Pale was similar to Jewish communities in Western Europe after or in the process of emancipation. In other ways, Russian Jewish society outside of the Pale is similar to their brethren within the Pale, and in some ways it's different than both. Taken together, it is quite a unique story of Russian Jewry. And understanding the story of Jews beyond the Pale can assist our understanding of many other related events, trends of Jewish history at that time and down to our own time. I'm going to point out a few of them. Number one, the ideas of integration and secularization are best viewed in these Jewish communities outside the Pale, because there it's seen in its extreme. Number two, the trends of immigration we tend to see as migration only to the United States, international. Here we have a trend of internal migration, which is another form, and it's something to study as well. Number three, a new form of leadership and shtadlonus, intercession with the government, active Jewish activism and politics, emerges as as a form of leadership of the St. Petersburg elite and of those Jews who were wealthy, less traditional, and living outside of the Pale of Settlement, quite distant from their brethren within the Pale. Number four, the rise of revolutionary and nationalistic movements in Russian Jewish society is somewhat related to this and their relative success because of this, the Jews within the Pale and Jews without the Pale struggle and who gets to live where. Number five, the pressing need to get out of the Pale remains with the Jews for the next century, to a certain extent down to this very day. And number six, a very overlooked aspect, the meteoric rise and integration of Soviet Jewry into Soviet society in the decades following the revolution until World War II is largely due to the fact that some Jews were allowed to live and integrate, selective integration in outside of the Pale of Settlement before the revolution. So this is Yehuda Gerber's Jewish History Soundbites. You can reach me at yehuda@yehudagerber.com for questions, comments, sources, tours, trips, sponsorships, and lectures. You can subscribe to Jewish History Soundbites on your favorite podcast platform, and I hope you enjoyed.